So, thank you, and I would like to move on to our next speaker duo. Last but not least, let me introduce you now to the next speakers. It's Amin Hussein and Natasha Dillon. Here you are. Both co-founder of TIDAO, Occupy Theory, Occupy Strategy, a movement generated theory magazine. And both are MTL, a collective that combines theory, research, aesthetics, and organizing in its art practice, and MTL Plus, facilitating decolonize this place. I think that's a nice ending for us today from the speaking. An action-oriented movement that blurs the lines between art. So, Amin Hussein studied philosophy, political science, and law, and practiced law for 5 years before transitioning to art. And he taught courses in art activism and strategic use of media. Natasha Dillon has a BA in mathematics from St. Stephen's College, University of Delhi, and attended the Whitney study program in New York and the International Center of Photography. She is a PhD candidate at the Department of Media Study, University of Buffalo in New York, and I'm very much looking forward to your speech. Where's Amin?
In the meantime, I can just tell you a little bit. This is a zine that we made. It's called Anemones. Anemones in Arabic means Shaqaq al-Nu'man. And Shaqaq al-Nu'man is indigenous to the Palestine, Lebanon, Syria. And the mythology of it, in part, is that when martyrs fall to the ground, their blood seeps into the soil. And this anemones emerges for only 2 to 3 weeks between winter and spring. And you can see them over the hill. And so this is the back of it. It's a poster. It was made in Palestine. The text kind of centers Palestine, but brings indigenous struggle, black liberation in conversation. And so text is translated from Spanish to English to Arabic to English to Spanish. And it was first released in Palestine. And it's a movement-generated theory kind of thing where we printed 50,000 copies of this, and it's in circulation. This is for free, so you can take it on your way out. And then also, there's these stickers, which is Decolonize This Place. It's what we're a part of, amongst others that we co-founded.
First, thank you, Alia, for the introduction and inviting us here. And thank you, everybody who helped organize this event. Before we begin talking, I just want to say that this is not just the work of me and Amin. There's a lot of people who are involved in the work that we've been doing. And I just wanted to acknowledge that. We could go to the next slide. So this is kind of a bit of a story of failures and successes and kind of like moving along the way. The thinking really comes from the Zapatistas, right? Walking, you ask questions and what you failed and what you succeeded and then you keep moving on. So for us, it begins with Occupy Wall Street. Me and Amin met at International Center of Photography. I'd just come from India. Amin had just given up law and we started a collective there called MTL Collective. And we started, one of the first things we did was go to Palestine and do a project called Cartography of an Occupation and understanding what occupation means, how does it actually function visually on the day-to-day level, how settlements are on the mountaintops, and how are Palestinians organizing with this idea of a failure of a nation state, right? And so that was one of our first projects. But with that, we went into Occupy Wall Street, and it was also around the same time when Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in Tunisia in 2011, which led to a set of Arab uprisings, right? And so then we are at Occupy Wall Street on September 17th, 2011. Occupy Wall Street had a lot of amazing things. It was an amazing anti-capitalist movement, but it was also a failure around centering race. But also apart from that, why would you already occupy a land that is already occupied? Even though that was mentioned while Occupy Wall Street was happening, and not just by, you know, people like us within the group, but also people like Decolonize NYC and other, extremely important Native American scholars like Sandy Grande, and also a lot of scholars from Oakland. So again, once again, but at the same time, the movement built this infrastructure, right, which has then been mobilizing in the city of New York through different struggles, Black Lives Matter, NYC Stands with Standing Rock, and most recently also components of it are present within Decolonize This Place. You want to?
Yeah, I can just say just a couple of things about the slide. In the sense that we together are MTL, but then we've done a lot of things that blur the lines between art and activism. We don't really use those words. I think to the extent that we think of art, art needs to measure up to us, not the other way around. In a way, kind of fuck Kant, you know, and all these people that talk about this certain aesthetic. It needs to emerge from the ground, and art needs to be responsive to people's struggle. You know, so when we talk about institutional critique, and we'll show you, we led the kind of work around the Whitney Museum in terms of removing the board of directors, we never thought of that as an intervention. We thought of that as building movement and people power and centering and decentering whiteness as a way to kind of collective liberation. Institutions, in a way, kind of embody capitalism with all its complexity. So it's not about necessarily a refusal of something, but it's the refusal that allows for a no that produces many yeses. And so this is the moment that we're kind of sharing. If you look up there on the top, there's MTL, but if you look at the other projects, these are things that we've done over the course of 8 years that ended probably in 2016 when we came up with Decolonize This Place. If we can go to the next slide. This is just a diagram of how we addressed the Brooklyn Museum when we raised the issue of they have stolen shit in their basement and then they put it up on exhibition. But we also kind of organized because they had a show called This Place. This Place normalized the occupation of Palestine and the settlers. So the figures of the Palestinians were very small, almost nondescript. But the settlers in the West Bank looked like they were from Brooklyn. In environmental portraits, right across them was something called Agitprop, a show that celebrated political art. So what we did was we organized with the community, because the Brooklyn Museum is also a gentrifying agent in the neighborhood. And we went into both galleries, took them over, used the concept of the supplement for Derrida, because the portraits that were up for Stephen Shore, Faisal Sheikh, all those people that cost $6 million to make with this humanist kind of eye, was renaming everything as if it has its Hebrew names and erased the Arabic names. What was important about that intervention, really quick, and this is the diagram that it represents, is the kind of organizing that goes in for a quote and unquote intervention to happen. In a way, we don't care whether people call it art. It probably will be perceived as art, as institutional critique, because it has something that resembles it. But more importantly, are we building power? Are we contesting power? Are we building relationships for a movement, for a society yet to come? And next slide.
I also just wanted to point out something about visionary organizing, which comes from Grace Lee Boggs and the Boggs Center in Detroit, right? So if you're organizing, and this is something really important because specifically the actions that we do usually get defined by media as protesters went to this museum and Candace needs to go out, or protesters. But none of us, define ourselves as protesters. We don't think of ourselves as protesters or this professionalization of the term activism. And so visionary organizing for us, that means is that if you're going into spaces to negate something, what are you also creating in the process? Who's coming to these actions? And what is the world that you're creating while you're doing these actions? And that's also extremely important, specifically if you start thinking about decolonization, because in New York City, but also otherwise, quite often decolonization is conflated with this idea of diversity, right? As if we'll have more people of color in our institution, that's going to fix the problem. And specifically in New York, and also other places, what settler colonial institutions do on a structural level cannot be changed by just diversity, right? And this is something that comes from Eve Tuck and Kay Wei Yang in a text called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor, where they define the project of social justice being separate from the project of decolonization, right? So if decolonization does not hold land, water, and air central to its project, it's a shell game. Right? So how does that project of holding land, water, and air central under the idea of settler colonization or capitalism, all of these things, then lead to building what we call decolonial solidarity, which also then leads to the idea of what decolonial formations could mean? So how does a coalition come about in a city, decolonial coalition, that then is not just reactionary based on one institution, but is a force in its own self, which can then not differentiate between the art institution or the city? Right? And so we're going to talk a little bit about it, where from the Whitney Museum, we then move to the MTA, the transit system, and it's the same groups that are organizing, and then the boundaries between art and activism and the city actually blur by the bodies that show up, by what these institutions do on a day-to-day level. Can we have the next slide, please?
So I'm going to, if we can just go quickly on the slides, I'll just kind of indicate this. We were in Palestine, and then in 2010, we thought to ourselves, what can we do? And this is when the uprisings began in, again, Tunisia, Egypt, and so forth. And one of the things that we did in Brooklyn was that we got the front page of the newspapers in which the uprisings were taking place in Arabic, removed the ads, printed out the front pages, annotated them, and printed them out in the thousands and distributed them in public parks. But what you know about cities in general and what you should know about New York is that there are no rocks. And that is not a coincidence. There's no rocks because if you have rocks, you probably throw them at the cops. If you have rocks, you probably throw them at the banks. So one of the things that our city doesn't have are rocks. And maybe that goes back to May 68, right, under the cobblestone, the beach, or any of those phraseologies. So one of the things that we wanted to do, now you could look at this and you can write about it, you can say it's a sculpture, or you can say whatever, but from our perspective, it's something aesthetic that required in public space, so it opened up that space for people to go to it, but in order to take it, they had to hold a rock in their hand. Right? That's the extent of it. And in the process, this was in the lead up to what then we helped organize, which is Occupy Wall Street. So if we can go to the next image. On the left-hand side is a map. That was the map that got distributed in the lead up to the occupation of Zuccotti Park. What we like to say after learning is deoccupation. And it had 8 locations. And the group was only 3 people that on the day of would decide where to go to outmaneuver the police. So they barricaded the first stop, and that's why how we were able to get the second stop. But it wasn't with using any technology. It was with word of mouth and our feet. And then the second one, if you see those shields, they look like book shields. They're done by a collective in Brooklyn called
Not an Alternative.
And they have messaging on them. And they've got these messages from a lot of different people, but they kind of revolved around medical care, healthcare, debt, and so forth, education. Next slide. Just a banner and an occupation of the park. But the reason we show this image is a lot of people thought that that was a white movement. And what happens is that people of color also get erased in the process. And some of this is counterinsurgency tactics. But I think so that's kind of why we show that image. Next image. Movement-generated theory. This is the title magazine, Occupy Theory, Occupy Strategy. And what we did there is we realized movements need to speak for themselves, but our movements are complex right now. So if you think of the multitude or whatever you're thinking about, we need spaces to have a conversation because we are not united. And I think that that's okay, but we also need to appreciate points of conflict as points of construction and really build around that. So what we did was create a magazine, but then did the research, the aesthetics, and collaborated with people like Gayatri Spivak, Judith Butler, Michael Hart, and many other thinkers, but to produce text that actually is legible for people on the street that are making decisions every day, coupled with organizers on the street. And this is the last issue of, if we can go down just to give you an example, next slide. Colonizer as lender. Occupy Wall Street, strike debt, free Palestine. So at that point in 2012, we were thinking of intersectionality and how debt is a mechanism of extraction of wealth upward, but it's also a mechanism that forces people to self-police. So one of the things that's happening right now is that, at least in the United States, we've gone from the thinking around welfare to something that we live in a debt-fare state. Everything is on debt. Everyone's below zero. In a way, the commons is a negative commons. This should open up pathways to what solidarity could look like, right? So, and what debts are owed to one another as groups. Next slide. Gulf labor.
This is mainly centered around the work with the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi and the Louvre Abu Dhabi, and as well as the NYU Abu Dhabi. So if you can go to the next slide. There's a place called Saadiyat Island in Abu Dhabi, which translates to the island of happiness, and it's the cultural district. It's 2.5 kilometers, I think, and it literally has all these different cultural institutions in that area, right? And it's actually part of this Real Estate 2020 project. And, like, of course, in New York, you know, art is a huge mechanism for gentrification, pushing out communities. Similarly, art is part of a real estate project here in Abu Dhabi. And and this is actually after the work around Occupy Wall Street, because one of the failures of Occupy Wall Street was also how it was perceived as a movement that's specifically coming from the United States. And if we know anything right now about a movement, we need to know that there's nothing that can be defined within nation states, right? Like, any movement that's thinking through nation states in its ideology is a failure. So then how can we start thinking about our spaces, where we inhabit, act where we are, and then amplify calls that are happening elsewhere as well? And so the Gulf Labor Project actually starts to define the complications of what it means to be a migrant worker. So I don't know if any of you've heard about this, but mostly the narratives around what's happening in Abu Dhabi is often into human rights framework of, like, look, these workers, they're victims there, we need to save them, or either in, like, oh, these are the sheikhs, and very orientalist narratives of, like, this is UAE, it's a monarchy. But what does it really mean to think about solidarity that is then transnational with labor and capitalism? So the project that we did was really doing research work in India, Abu Dhabi, and then doing actions in New York, but also not just research around, like, how debt or lending is kind of like putting a lot of weight on the workers, but also how workers are organizing on the day-to-day level. And we know that these news or these things do not come out on media. So the things are happening on WhatsApp, people are shutting down factories every day. And a lot of this work also comes from Faridabad Mazdoor Samachar, which is a horizontal workers' news newspaper that looks at organizing that's happening outside of the unions in Delhi. And if you look at it right now, there's organizing happening around Honda and also Maruti Suzuki, which was also a huge moment in 2011, where it was also the idea of deoccupation of a factory also came from there. And so what does it mean for us to think about what migrant workers mean when in India you have migrant workers moving from villages to cities and then going to the Gulf and then the dream of coming to the United States or Canada? So what is the Gulf dream, and then how do our institutions like the Louvre Abu Dhabi and the Guggenheim kind of facilitate that process? If you can have the next slide, please. So that's the Guggenheim, that's the Louvre. So one of the things that we do with these actions is that how can you couple very real demands with unimaginable demands, right? The idea of, like, having a demand that opens up space. So with the Gulf Labor Campaign, we had three things, right? A living wage, a rolling jubilee, and a debt jubilee, and the right to organize, which are three things, right? Most of the workers in the UAE don't get paid a living wage based on Abu Dhabi. They get a living wage based on Delhi, but that does not mean that they can actually spend money in places like Abu Dhabi or Dubai. Even though workers organize, there's nothing on the books, so you have no right to organize. And then the third one is, what did I say?
Mm-hmm. Right for workers to organize, debt jubilee.
And then there was one more. Living wage, yes. So those are the three things. So then when we're in New York, can you move to the next slide, please? This is the Louvre Abu Dhabi in 2015, under construction. And this is the other crazy thing, right? This entire project is about making art history not Western anymore. Right. This is how Richard Armstrong from the Guggenheim actually explains why the Guggenheim should be in Abu Dhabi, because art history for too long has been Western, and this is one of the ways we can actually do it. But then who builds your architecture, right? Who built the White House? Who built these states? How is the wealth actually accumulated in these countries? So next slide. And, you know, these are mainly labor camps that are there close to the Louvre Abu Dhabi. So one of the other things that happens is most of the workers actually travel 2 hours every day to actually come to these construction sites. So apart from the 12-hour of over, you know, like the workday, you have additional 4 hours extra of working and then going to sleep and, you know, taking a shower and things like that. Next slide, please. And so you want to talk about this?
Yeah. So in learning from failures, how do you organize together? How do you come together in a decolonial solidarity? How do you come together not thinking there's a victim, I'm going to help them? Because Fred Moten says something like, I don't need your help. I just need you to know that this shit's killing you too. And then he curses. But Fred Moten is this black philosopher, poet, deeply influential right now in the United States. But if you look at these columns, this is got printed out as maybe 8x11, and different groups got invited, students, artists. One of the things that we didn't mention is this is part of a larger campaign, right? Some of you may have heard of Gulf Labor Artists Coalition. It has Hans Haka, Walid Raad, all these people. Part of how we got into that is that they realized the museum wasn't listening to them, so they did something called 52 Weeks. And we were in charge of week 10. So for week 10, we said, we're not going to make art, but we'll make a solidarity action. This was the basis upon which we invited people in the room. And we had these conversations, and we said, you know what? If your boycott is only limited to Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, and you have 1,500 artists that have signed this boycott, we need to create leverage. And the way we're going to create leverage is we're going to do direct actions and open up a new front at their flagship in New York. And so what you'll see is this is the basis by which, how does the MFA relate, and this is research, right? But this is research in the service of organizing and building movements, not research so you can put it in a book and actually have like tenure track. It's a different way of doing things. And it requires to be accessible. And it requires for it not to have a purpose of bringing people in the room and then those people having agency to figure out the next step. Next slide, please. This is just the research, and I'll say this. Part of what happened is that Okwi and Weser then invited us to Venice, but then we took the money and went to Delhi and went to around different parts, like different areas, to speak to workers who returned because the workers didn't feel as free, perhaps, to speak in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, right? And these particular workers burnt their passports, promising never to return. Next slide, please. This is a collaboration with the Illuminator. Again, seeing some of the symbolism of Occupy Wall Street, but actually hacking the facade of a museum, a known symbol, right? And this hurts their brand, because then this allows for media to be made and for the story to carry a different narrative that otherwise wouldn't be open, the New York Times wouldn't be open to. Do you want to continue?
No, you can keep.
Next slide. All right, this is another example of an action. This action, they had some futurist show, right? Italian futurist show. And what we did this time around is like, how can we make the organizing decentralized? So we invited people to the Met. We had made our own art, and we had printed it out, and we had non-adhesive tape, and we brought people together, around 80 people, and we said, be in groups of three. Someone to de-escalate, someone to take a picture, and someone to actually touch the white walls that produce value, right, at the museum. Many of these artworks were worth millions of dollars, are insured, are being lent. So the act of these people crossing over and getting close to this artwork meant that their insurance went up. It meant that the people that lent their artwork asked for it back. And it was also how we ended up being with the Board of Trustees, having negotiations about what the Guggenheim can do. And one of their first things is that the director said this was distasteful. This was the thing that kind of upset them. But simultaneously, they said, if you cease hostilities, we can talk. Which is interesting, right? Because that's the colonial mentality. Act civil. And then somehow power recognizes you, right? But part of what we did here, and this is one of the lessons, is the Gulf Labor Artists Coalition as a project has its human rights framework as a model. And we realized that had its limitations, which then brings us to decolonize.
If you could go next slide.
Go ahead.
Next slide.
Okay. Just really quickly, I think that in 2014, as we were doing the Guggenheim work, the war on Gaza erupted. The war on Gaza is probably accurate. And I think that it's happening right now where Israel has been bombing Gaza that's been under siege for over 8-9 years. But one of the things that we did was we organized a Sea of Flags march on the Brooklyn Museum. they all blend together. On the Brooklyn Bridge. This is the Manhattan Bridge, right? So in a way to throw off the cops and surveillance, we announced and really put it on blast that there's a huge march that's not permitted on the Brooklyn Bridge. But then a group of 15 people who were working in the basements of churches for a month bought this flag, the cloth, and sewed it and painted it, and it's 90 feet by 45 feet, and trained to drop it in less than 20 seconds. With all these ways of like how to document it, how it got timed with the march that was passing, this ended up going viral, and it's still being used by even Zionist outlets, right? But what it does do is that it forces you as a way, it gives you a news event that then forces you to say what boycott, divestment, and sanction of the state of Israel is. Next slide. Simultaneously with this moment, Black Lives Matter erupted. And this is the moment, if you want to think of aesthetics, what does it mean to kind of throw down for black liberation? And what we saw is that the color was black and white. And what we wanted to do is like, how do we kind of contribute to something that was happening? Because there was a millions march that was called. And if you heard Eric Garner, who was selling loose cigarettes, was choked to death by a cop. And he said, I can't breathe 11 times. So we made these banners that are 30 feet by 5 feet that said, Black Lives Matter, for each time he said, I can't breathe. And on the side, the Palestinian kufiya. And then the 12th banner was, when we breathe together, which is something that we heard some of the people saying in the street. But we also organized an affinity group, so the huge march was happening, and then these banners were shutting down intersections, chokeholds, protecting people, helping the messaging happening. And then it got diffused into the city, and they're still used today. Go ahead.
Next slide. So in 2016, we were offered an exhibition by Artist Space, which is a contemporary art gallery in downtown Manhattan. And something about Artist Space was that the city cut its funding, and it was the reason why... Yeah, we just 2 minutes and it's okay. So the city cut funding for this art institution, and they were supposed to move to Brooklyn. And they started thinking, what would it mean for them to be a gentrifying force? So they wanted to actually think about what an exhibition means around that. But if you think about it, Artist Space, the rent for that space is $18,000 per month. They have never had an exhibition that's costed them less than $20,000 to hang. So when they invited us as MTL, one of the things that we thought about is like, if we have these many resources, does it really make sense to put up an exhibition? So instead, we turned the space into a movement space, not just any kind of movement space, but a decolonial movement space that starts to think of it from the land up, right? So the land that we are standing on, to the neighborhood that we are in, and to the things that we are struggling with, both locally and globally, right? Act locally, think globally. So that's when we came up with the idea of the five strands, which is indigenous sovereignty, you know, starting from we are on the Lenape land, black liberation, who built the infrastructure of the country, what was the history of slavery, and then Free Palestine and the project of settler colonization, and it keeps going on. Global wage workers, so how are we actually so linked into this wage economy, not just in terms of nation states? And then de-gentrification, how are our art institutions actively participating in gentrifying communities and displacing people? And then the one that's not on there is dismantling patriarchy, even though that's in everything that we do, but that was something that we had to particularly name. And from this project, this common space that was in New York City, then we did a lot of actions. If you could just go to the next slide. So there were just, you know, we didn't think of it. We thought of the idea of banners so that they could actually be hung off the wall, and if there's some action happening, you take them out and replace them. And so it kept the space kind of like moving and also defined the politics of the space as we were doing different things. Next slide. Just the space and the activities in there and different generations. Next slide. And so this is the, you know, we could just move through. I think it's better to talk about the Whitney to wrap it up. But this is, these are posters from action at the American Museum of Natural History. So American Museum of Natural History is the most funded museum by the city in New York City. It's also the most visited museum in terms of tourists, but also school children. And, you know, we call it a hall of white supremacy because it's built on the legacy of Roosevelt, which is built on the legacy of eugenics. And the way the entire museum is structured is, you know, like African peoples, African halls, African mammals, Asian peoples, Asian mammals, and it actually renders indigenous people invisible as if they used to live in the past. And it has a very small section on slavery, and that also does not define. It just talks about the culture that black folks brought to America. So we've used we've actually been to the American Museum of Natural History for the last 3 years. This year we actually walked from the steps of the museum to the city and to Central Park in front of it. But the three demands that we've had is remove the statue, which is a statue of Theodore Roosevelt in front. If you could move to the next slide, in front of the museum, that's the statue. And on the left-hand side is from our first action. And on the right-hand side is an autonomous group called Monument Removal Brigade who did that. And so the three, once again, this idea of meeting possible demands with impossible demands, right? So removing the statue because this statue should go, right? Why are we glorifying settler colonization, but also imperialism and racism. This is a Theodore Roosevelt statue, which is facing east, has a black and a native man on its east side. And then renaming the day, so we still have Columbus Day, and so renaming that to Indigenous Peoples Day. And a broader demand, which is respecting the ancestors, which actually asks for an entire overhaul of the institution in itself, right? And not just acknowledging its colonial history, but actually acting today in the ways an institution can. And just if you just keep going, then we'll just go through these images. So I think very quickly about the Whitney organizing. So Warren Canders, who runs the company called Safari Land, he produces tear gas that is used in Palestine, Egypt, Baltimore, Ferguson. It was most recently used on Tijuana border, Turkey. Was one of the vice chairmen of the board of the Whitney Museum, and there was basically I don't know if you guys know the migrant caravan that came to the Tijuana border, and then this tear gas was used there. And Hyperlogic, which is an art media publication, released a report on how this tear gas is being used on the border, and Warren Canders, who is at the Whitney, is there. This is when I think the idea of like what's inside the institution and outside the institution is also blurs, right? So the 100 staff from the Whitney Museum decided to write a letter asking their institution to be accountable to them, to institute a process of who the Board of Trustees are and what that means. Very quickly, the institution buckled down. The staff was, you know, surveilled, and it limited their mobilizing of, you know, what they could do. And then that's when I think several community groups, based on the work that we'd already been doing, were able to act fast, but not in a reactionary way, but in a visionary way. And that's when that brought the 9 weeks of art and organizing around the Whitney Museum, which went from crisis to decolonization, right? So Warren Canders is one problem, right, one part of the problem, but the entire structure needs to be, you know, rethought, built, whatever. Yeah.
So if we can just show the slides really quickly, and we'll go week one, all right, tear gas, and you could see an image at the end. Week two. All right, now we have poetry and singing. Quick note, none of these were sanctioned by the museum. They were forced in. We took over space. Sometime we took the gallery. We lit sage. The sage, its smell lasted for a week. It also harmed them deeply. And because it's important to level material blows that are also are not perceived as belligerent. Right. So, and this is, I think, where the last speaker, some of this stuff was being deployed. Then we wrote letters, right, and delivered them. We made posters for each week.
We could keep next. Going fast.
Okay. Talking about gentrification and how it's related to the galleries that moved to Chinatown, because the Whitney is a gentrifying force. This was the Great March of Return, so the Palestinian community, because they're also using bullets. So we start, this was also in collaboration with Forensic Architecture, in which we gave them information. They published stuff. They were in the Whitney Biennial. So there was a lot of organizing. Puerto Rico was a settler, it's a colonial colony of the United States. The students came out. We also highlighted other problematic figures on the Board of Trustees. Next. The train that came out from far out in Brooklyn all the way to the Whitney, this was the first time we had arrests. The banner drops on the museum and inside, this got timed at with the opening of the Whitney Biennial. But then again, through security culture, we knew exactly where Warren Kanders lived and we went to his house. That was the march of about 500 people. And now we just end here, which is, you know, we knew from the Whitney, we needed to pivot to the city. And I think the one thing that we were doing is that decolonization is not about purity. We don't know if these settler colonial institutions are salvageable or not. We've delivered the message that a decolonization process with communities as stakeholders at the table where the museum relinquishes control and is part of a process is what's demanded. In the absence of that, they remain open files. The American Museum of Natural History, the Brooklyn Museum, the Guggenheim, the Whitney Museum. As we keep them open files, we've just been organizing around the transport and fuck the police.
Don't forget to take your...